Thank you for the welcome. And it was an interesting welcome for me mentioning the piece of land that's been bought down in Kelmscott. The piece of land that's been bought in Kelmscott Rawleystone was owned by my grandfather. And so it's a really interesting connection for me that it's now part of the BSWA. When I told Mum that BSWA had bought the land, she said, I'm not sure how he would have thought about it. But given that my mum was the first person who took me to the Armidale group to meditate, she thinks it's wonderful. So it's a really nice connection with, as Anusha said, a beautiful piece of land, a little bit out of the city. I probably will talk for a few minutes before we start the meditation, not too long. But I wanted to just explicitly welcome everybody. Whatever your particular interest is in being here, whatever your history, whatever religious background, you can come here and participate as a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, an atheist, a confused being. Everybody is welcome. And that's one of the beautiful things I think about this centre. And I read recently a lovely quote by Thich Nhat Hanh, where he said, "Oh, you can still practice Christianity and, you know, Judaism and Islam and Buddhism." So it's an interesting and inclusive and very welcoming approach to what we'll be doing. In a big way, Buddhism is concerned about alleviating suffering, responding to the suffering of the world. And suffering doesn't discriminate. So all of us here know suffering as well as know joy. It's part of the human condition. And so if there's something that being together and meditating supports us in responding to those challenges of being human, how good, how good. So everybody, every individual here is really welcome. And all of you as an individual is welcome. You know, the good, the bad, the ugly of who you are. Whether you've arrived tonight and are a bit cranky, whether you're a bit tired, a bit agitated, whatever's going on, it's all welcome. Buddhist psychology has been so useful in supporting us to get a different way of relating to the things that arise within us. And this can help us go into the meditation, remembering that the orientation that we're taking is one of acceptance of this moment, acceptance of how I am, rather than fighting and pushing away and resisting and coming with a big agenda. At one level, fighting's pointless because the experience is already here. And fighting also has the effect of activating our nervous system and just adding additional stress. So we're learning through the meditation to respond with more skillful means to the challenges, those little challenges that are arising during the meditation. And for most of us, there will be challenges. It's part of having a human mind. One of the very well-used quotes from Carl Rogers talks to this as well. He says that the curious paradox is when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. So going into the meditation, it can be useful to have a bit of a sense of your intention of being here. And I thought I'd read a piece by Wes Niska. He's very involved in Spirit Rock in the US, some of you might know about. And it's called Why I Meditate. I meditate because I suffer. I suffer, therefore I am. I am, therefore I meditate. I meditate because there's so many other things to do. I meditate because when I was younger, it was all the rage. I meditate because Siddhartha Gautama, Bodhidharma, Marco Polo, the British Raj, Carl Jung, Alan Watts, Jack Kerouac, Alfred E. Newman et al. I meditate because evolution gave me a big brain and it didn't come with an instruction manual. I meditate because I have all the information I need. I meditate because the largest colonies of living beings, the coral reefs, are dying. I meditate because I want to touch deep time, where the history of humanity can be seen as just an evolutionary adjustment period. I meditate because life is too short and sitting slows it down. I meditate because life is too long and I need an occasional break. I meditate because I want to experience the world as Rumi did, or Walt Whitman, or as Mary Oliver. I meditate because now I know that enlightenment doesn't exist, so I can relax. I meditate because of the Dalai Lama's laugh. I meditate because there are too many advertisements in my head and I'm embracing them all but the very best of them. I meditate because the physicists say there may be 11 dimensions to reality and I want to get a peek at a few more of them. I meditate because I've discovered that my mind is a great toy and I like to play with it. I meditate because I want to remember that I'm perfectly human. Sometimes I meditate because my heart is breaking. Sometimes I meditate so that my heart will break. I meditate because a Vedanta master once told me that in Hindi my name, Niska, means non-doer. I meditate because I'm growing old and want to become more comfortable with emptiness. So just having a little pause and checking in with, why are you meditating? Why am I meditating? Bhikkhu Anālayo says that it's useful to have an altruistic component of the intention, something that gets us beyond the I, me, mine. And even though it does feel a bit grand saying this, in some ways part of my intention is to be in some way of service in the healing of the world and the creation of a sustainable society. But grand or small, a little bit of peace in this moment, it doesn't really matter. Just having a sense of, why are we here? And settling in, finding the position that will support you for the next half an hour. Letting the body maybe guide you in what it needs for the moment. So listening into the body as we gently close the eyes if that's comfortable. Or just find a place to rest the gaze if you'd prefer to keep the eyes open. Listening to the body. And settling the body. It's likely that it's done an awful lot of things today. By listening and caring for it now, the body knows that it's been looked after and can perhaps settle a little more easily. finding balance in the body. Pema Chodron talks of equanimity as being represented by a soft front and a strong back. And touching that in the body can support that balance, that openness through the front, openness, care, friendliness, kindness, soft front. And at the back, strong back, stability, presence, groundedness. Coming home to this body. And from this soft front and strong back, opening with kindness to the moment, this moment, as you're experiencing it. Good enough. Coming to this moment with curiosity, without any agenda, other than to be with it in kind relationship. After a day of activities and stimulation, there may be a lot of mental activity still whirring through the mind. Not a problem. That's what human minds do. Just letting it be. Gently coming on back home to the body. Soft front, strong back. We may get caught in thought and find ourselves drawn into a story. Not a problem. Letting the story go, letting it be. And gently redirecting the attention home to the body, feeling into the body. Soft front, strong back. This gentle but firm training of the mind may or may not be easy, may or may not be pleasant tonight, but it's always worthwhile. From another teacher, little needs much contentment. coming home to the body resting, the body breathing. Soft front, strong back. And if you need to adjust the energy levels a little, feel free to maybe bring a little bit more lift through the body. And we're coming towards the end of tonight's practice. It can be interesting to notice what happens in the mind with that information. Just watching, bringing mindfulness to the thoughts and the feelings that they might be very slight that arise. Maybe some habitual ways of getting yourself ready to bring a meditation to a close. You might notice patterns. In a moment, I'll ring the bell. And that can be the signal for us to finish tonight's practice. Yeah, I'm seeing some people doing some stretching. Feel free. Rub the face, rub the hands. What does the body need at the end of the practice? My body needs a little bit of water. There's a couple of things I thought I might talk about tonight. And the first one, I'm using Nigel Welling's book to sort of frame the conversation. His book is Why Can't I Meditate? Great book. It's a really good one. For all of us who at times find that, you know, in our daily or our weekly practice that we're doing, our experience of the meditation is anything but that, you know, beautiful, blissful looking image of the woman on the mountaintop that they use to sell meditation these days. You know, sometimes what's going on in our head is completely different. And sometimes the way that the monks talk about it, you know, the monks who are doing lots and lots of practice daily, they might talk about meditation in a way that feels like it's completely alien to our experience of it. You know, we sit down to meditate sometimes and it seems like the pet owner has let the hamsters out of the cages and they are running a million miles in the hamster wheels of the head. You know, different stories going. Worries about what's going to happen tomorrow, rehashing what conversations we had earlier today, noticing different feelings, all sorts of different things come up and get in the way as those hamster wheels spin. Agitation, restlessness, or we might find we just drop off. It's just this sort of hazy space. Not quite sure where we are, what's going on. It feels very yummy, but we're anything but really present to what's going on. I remember maybe 15 years ago doing a retreat with Ajahn Vayama, who leads the chanting here before the meditation. And I went and spoke with her. I said, look, it just seems like every time I meditate, I'm doing it for the first time. I've got this crazy mind. And her response was so helpful for me. She said, are you living a busy life? I said, yeah, I'm living a very busy life. She said, the human mind needs downtime. We put all of this information, we have all of these experiences. Our minds need downtime to just process the information. And your mind is saying, oh, fantastic. For a moment, she's just stopped and is not putting anything more, not asking anything of it. And so it's just doing its own little processing. She said, are you noticing any benefits, though, in your day, in the rest of your life? I said, oh, yeah, no, I can see benefits in the rest of my life. It's my meditation practice that feels every day. It's, you know, what is it, Groundhog Day? And she said, well, that's most important, to be able to see the benefits in your daily life. I used to be the sibling, you know, there were four of us kids. I was the sibling that my brothers and sisters would just try and get a rise out of, because it was very easy. I was reactive, so they would bait me and I'd bite back. So one of the things I had been noticing was just a slow, and it's an ongoing process, it's still a work in progress, easing of some of the reactivity that I was aware of. And she says, yeah, that kind of thing. So I just want to normalise that for most of us that live pretty busy lives, meditation won't always be beautiful and blissful and, one step off nirvana. We, in our modern world, have somehow created a situation where it's non-stop input of information for most of us. We are so overstimulated. The natural periods of downtime that used to exist for our minds and are so important for our minds have been gobbled up, because now often what happens is a moment of downtime, so we get out a device and put more things in. And often what we're putting in isn't especially calming. The news, full of distressing stories, And we don't always remember that it's news because it's different from the norm. It can be really useful to remember that it's only news because it's different from the norm. The norm actually for most of us is a pretty okay kind of day. But we get all of these difficult and distressing situations so that we can, our poor old nervous system can be quite activated, or we get into situations of empathic distress with other people that we're hearing about, not necessarily having skillful means to deal with that. Or we might find the old comparing mind arising when we look at Facebook and see the fantastic lives all of our friends are having, and why not me? So, you know, all of these different ways that we keep our mind engaged and not always in productive ways means that, you know, when we do stop and sit to meditate, it's not always going to be straightforward. If we can notice some benefit in the rest of our life, that's where the rubber hits the road. That's why we're doing it. Yeah. My initial exploration of Buddhist meditation was in the early 1990s at the Armidale BSWA, and I still am a regular attender there. My parents live in Kelmscott, so I go and visit them, have tea with them, and then go and have the meditation at the Armidale group. And it started for me pretty much as crisis management. I'd go to the meditation and Dharma talk when my life was getting a bit challenging. And then I'd fall off the cushion. Something else had happened, so I'd get the fix from the meditation and the Dharma talks. And found it so useful to hear about the reality of suffering being part of life, and the reality and the promise and the ways, the skillful ways that we can relate to suffering so that we don't add additional suffering to the already initial situation. Our suffering comes in all shapes and sizes. You know, we have suffering that is just because we've got a human body, pains and aches and getting old and different things happening. We've got suffering because we've got a human mind that can imagine, and imagine not always in positive ways. It's not always, you know, our beautiful creative mind finding cures for malaria. Sometimes the imagination is going in ways that are not so helpful, creating scenarios that are more distressing. So we have suffering that we cause just because we've got this human mind, heart, body. And then we've got suffering that is interpersonal, suffering because we're in relationship with others. And if we think about how challenging it can be to stay mindful and present and grounded when we are with another, you know, we can see how sensitive we are to being in the presence of another. So there's suffering in relationships, and then there's suffering that different groups cause each other as well. Earlier in my adult life, I was very active and interested in social justice issues, looking at the different ways that human beings cause suffering to others because of how they use their power over, and discriminate on the basis of, you know, religion and race and ability, age. I spent a number of years working in the refugee area, worked for Case for Refugees, looking for ways to minimise that structural suffering that human beings create. that was really important to me early in my adult years. In the beginning of this decade, when I decided I wanted to make meditation and the practice a bigger part of my life, I then thought, oh, well, I'll make it my work. That'll be a bigger part of my life. So went off to the University of Massachusetts and did their instructor training at the medical school for mindfulness-based stress reduction. And really around that time had more of a focus, and since that time I've had more of a focus on the intrapersonal suffering, the challenges of having a human mind and a human body and a human nervous system. My volunteer work then at that time also became much more interested in responding to the individual suffering of individuals. I've been a lifeline telephone counsellor for, 8 years, something like that. And so that's a very individual way to respond to suffering rather than looking at it in the structural sense that I was interested in from a social justice aspect previously. The individual levels of suffering come because we are hardwired to react to situations that we perceive to be threatening. Our fight-flight-freeze system very easily turned on. We're also hardwired to run after rewards, resources, bling. That might sound like craving. Second noble truth. That creates awful lot of suffering for us. And one of the really interesting things, well, it's interesting to me, that's been discovered in the last couple of decades is that the human brain, the reward system of the human brain, releases the dopamine in the phase of anticipation, in the phase of wanting, in the phase of desire, not when we get the reward. The brain's reward system actually has two parts to it, and the biggest, by far, the most easily turned on is the part of the reward system that keeps us wanting, that keeps us running after bling. And learning that made me think the Buddha discovered that from the inside out, and now the neuroscientists are finding it from the different studies that they are doing. How do we deal with this hardwiring? Another way that our mind works is when we're just not doing anything in particular, the default mode network of the human mind generally is thinking about itself. I, me, mine. And that often has a little level of dissatisfaction to it because, I want something a bit different. It's not so good. Why do they have it and not me? And da, 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 da. We have a mind that very easily can generate challenges for us, our own suffering. And so we've got this individual aspect to our suffering, and we've also got the structural aspects to suffering. And in the last 18 months, I've actually gone back a little bit to being more interested in some of those bigger picture aspects of suffering. In particular, looking at the suffering we cause each other and the planet. Obviously, one of the biggest issues at the moment is the climate crisis. And so the suffering connected with how we relate to the planet is something that is exercising my mind a lot. And I feel very grateful to Buddhist psychology for providing many different insights into enabling us to deal with this crisis in a way that may be more life-giving rather than antagonistic and cause more suffering. It would be very easy to respond to, I think, the climate crisis in a way which just causes more division, more antagonism, more hate. One of the things that we learn from the Buddha is that anger, which is quite likely to be part of the whole response to the climate crisis, anger's a defilement of the mind and gets in the way of skillful action. Now, most of us, I don't know if there's anybody enlightened here, but most of us will feel anger from time to time in relation to different things. And so it's part of being a human, and it's not to go to war with ourselves because at times we feel angry, but it's how do we deal with that anger, to use the information and not work from a place of anger, but simply using the anger perhaps as useful information in responding to the different things, such as climate crisis, that we are facing. Another really useful aspect from Buddhist psychology and understanding of the human mind is the practice of mindfulness itself. Mindfulness is inviting us to know our experience, to turn towards our experience, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. It's not saying, oh, only have good experiences. Because of course that would be impossible. How do we be with our unpleasant? How do we be with our experience when we don't want it? How do we be with our experience when it's unpleasant? Mindfulness is really vital to be able to keep us in contact with our experience, even if it's uncomfortable, and support us to incorporate and integrate all of the aspects of who we are. And then the Buddha also talks about equanimity as being a really vital component to cultivate. So important when we are in difficult situations. And compassion too. Compassion is not unique to Buddhism, of course. Many of these things aren't. Some are. But the compassion, not only for ourselves when we're in a situation which we don't know how to behave, what to do, but compassion also for the people who are making decisions that are so destructive for the planet. What is it that in their conditioning, what happened in their lives that this makes sense? So rather than vilifying, understanding that they are the heirs of their karma also. They are living out they are in response to the experiences of their life. The last thing that I'm going to talk about in relation to how I find Buddhist psychology really helpful in responding to help me respond to the climate crisis, and also I think to, in a bigger sense, it's of value to how we respond to the climate crisis, is the element of renunciation. Now, I don't know how often renunciation is talked about here in this hall. When we go on retreat, it's often talked about. And it's so not sexy in our modern world, renunciation. It sounds so much about, sounds very austere and intense and not much fun. And it's a very complex topic in Buddhism, and I am not going to do it justice within the Buddhist framework. But I do want to talk about it in terms of how we respond to the situation that we're finding ourselves in. One of the aspects of renunciation is a loosening of attachment to worldly pleasures, to sense pleasures. The fact that you are here, in fact, is a small act of renunciation. You could be out at the pub, lots of music, dancing, having a really good time, doing something else. Hopefully you're here having a really good time, but you're not here chasing, filling up, responding to the sense desires that we have. There's another purpose. And the planet needs us to renounce our worldly desires. The planet can't support the extent of our worldly desires. the overconsumption that is part of most of our lives, and I'm not sitting here a paragon of virtue, this is a work in progress for me too, has had a major impact on the planet. We need to somehow turn around our attitudes and value non-consumption, value not just chasing what's going to give us a momentary hit of dopamine as we're in the anticipation. One of the benefits of renunciation is that we stop being enslaved by our attachment to sense pleasure. We stop being enslaved by our desires. So there's a real freedom that comes from this practice. How can we talk about this and the freedom and the benefits of not chasing what looks like a good idea, the next bit of bling? Renunciation is so countercultural. Advertising is a major tool of consumer capitalism, which is creating desires. You know, you look at an advert, you didn't even know that thing existed. There's a great story of the Dalai Lama being driven down some street in the US, and he just describes afterwards being mesmerised by these shops selling all these things that he didn't know even existed, and watching desire arise. Fortunately, the Dalai Lama has a lot more capacity to watch that process come and go without it actually causing him to behave in particular ways. Most of us don't. Most of us have desire act. This practice is good for us, good for the planet. One of my little fantasies, if I ever get to be dictator of the world, is the first thing I'm going to do is stop advertising. I'm not going to stop information about products, but I'm going to stop advertising. So I'll have a government department, Ministry of Information, where you can go and get all of the information. The producers can go and put all of the information there, but you'll have to choose to go and get it. They won't have the freedom to push it down our throats on the back of buses, on the internet, on television, in magazines, on the back of cars. We are bombarded with desire-creating messages, squillions of them every day. And in the meantime, until I am dictator of the world, I'll need to work on my own desires and see if I can strengthen renunciation as part of my capacity. And I have mixed experience with renunciation. I love food. I love food, and particularly on retreat, that is a great place to observe desire and food and how I deal with it. And it's not an easy thing for me to make choices that are restrained in relation to food. In some other areas of my life, renunciation's easy. I shop at op shops. I am not a big consumer of stuff, and I'm very grateful for my parents and their way of being, where that wasn't part of my upbringing. If it had been different, I probably would be. So it's not to vilify people who are in that consumptive mode, but it's to find ways that we can support people to find rewards in non-consumption that I think is so important at the moment. How do we make simplicity, frugality, abstinence, how do we make those things attractive, sexy? That's the challenge. And they're so vital. as I mentioned, even though we might be told renunciation is in some way sort of reducing our freedom, the opposite is true. If we're able to be free of these desires, we're in a much more liberated state. There are other things in relation to taking action on the climate crisis where I think renunciation has a place to play too. I think it's easy to get into a sense of being right and righteous. We can renounce that. I can renounce that. It's easy to get into a state of having a sense of knowing what other people should do. We, at times, need certainty. If we're committing to act, to whether it's to take action through the students' strike, Extinction Rebellion, through other means, we sometimes might think, well, we need certainty that what we're doing is going to pay off. And we don't know. So maybe we can renounce certainty as well. Because if we wait for certainty to act, it might all be a little bit too late. We don't know how things are going to turn out. And yet there's still, I think it's still vital for us to be engaged in taking planet-friendly action. There's a quote from Thomas Merton. He said that an activist has to come to terms with the fact that what is done may ultimately be fruitless, but one should focus on the value, the rightness of the things for itself. And there's a story from the Talmud which says that if the world were ending, knowing that nothing would make a difference, a wise, caring person would still do what's most aligned with their heart's deepest values. So, needing certainty might be something else that we can renounce and still engage in useful, planet-friendly action. One of the things that I've been doing over this year is, with a friend colleague, we've been working with a group using Joanna Macy's book, Active Hope. Joanna Macy is a Buddhist professor and has been an activist for 40, 50 years. One of the really useful things about her approach to training in this area is she uses a spiral. It starts from gratitude. The second step is honouring our pain. The third step is seeing with new eyes. The fourth step is going forth. Now that second step, honouring our pain, is something that's often overlooked because it's too hard to actually talk about our pain, the despair, the sadness, the grief. And yet finding spaces for us to acknowledge the impact of living in the time that we do and responding to that in life-giving ways in community is really important. There's a great podcast where she's interviewed by the Extinction Rebellion mob and talks about the connection between her work and the work of environmental activists at the moment. I'd be really, really interested to hear from people here about how they see renunciation working either in your own life or in, and how we can make it something that's attractive to others. because I'm keen to spread the word on this in a way that can be heard. And I'm sure there are lots of people here with some really interesting ways you've thought about it. This isn't, you know, something new for many of you. I'd love to hear if there are some experiences or ideas out there. Anybody been contemplating this and playing with this? Yeah.
Thanks very much. Hi. I've been just very, very recently, it's amazing the timing of this, we've been watching some documentaries on what foods people eat and how that impacts the environment. Mm. And we've recently made the decision to renunciate eating meat due to the huge impact, far more than fossil fuels, that it's having on the environment.
Yeah.
And it's really amazing. And it's eating meat is such a normal part of the broader culture, yet it's such a destructive thing. And I had no idea. I was completely ignorant until I actually delved into it a bit more for purely selfish reasons at the time, which were health. But the greater environment is... this is something that I can do. I felt helpless before, but this is actually something I have power over. So that's our journey. I'm not saying that to bang the drum for anyone else who still eats meat. That's okay. But renunciating that has been empowering, and it's a journey that we're on at the moment.
How good. It's been empowering. Mm. Renouncing something is empowering.
Yeah.
Terrific. And... similarly, I'm on that same journey. I have a dream to get to being a vegan. And it's step by step by step. Occasionally, I still eat a chili cheese Kransky from the Bain Marie. But, and I really appreciate the gentleness of, you know, this is my step, and we will have different steps. So it's not about vilifying people who aren't perfect. It's about encouraging us to take that next step. Yeah, thank you.
I've recently been thinking about something very similar, and I think we have to somehow encourage long-term thinking or longevity. You know, we live in a world where hedonistic sort of indulgences are very common in our society and also encouraged. Yeah, I don't know. I totally agree with you, but I can't see how we can change popular culture's perspective on those influences. But yeah, I think longevity is the ultimate goal there.
So long-term thinking, yeah. And it may be too. I was wondering, as you were talking about the giving up meat, have you told people about it?
We have a friend who is further ahead on this journey, and he has a very gentle approach, and he just says, this is something that's good for myself. Go and research it yourself. And that was very non-threatening. Mm-hmm. And so we did. And this is really the first public declaration that we've made for it. So yes, but only tonight. So we're very new on that journey, but we're quite determined.
Yeah, because talking about it as a normal thing to do just encourages other people, not as a, you know, you should be. More and more we hear about people taking steps, doing things, living simply, living frugally, you know, not using plastics, all these things. Most people want to move in that direction in some way, shape or form. And so I think if we talk about it, it can be really encouraging. And the how we do that is important too, you know, encouraging, loving way. Yeah. Other responses? Yeah. Got a big voice?
Yeah, sorry, I don't know exactly what to start with. I feel it's hypocritical possibly, because didn't you mention advertising and you want to dissuade this as a like a tactic in general? This was your utopian dream, yeah?
Sorry, it's a little bit hard to hear.
This is your utopian dream, right? To dissuade people from advertising, eventually, perhaps, in what you said.
Yeah.
So it's... well, like for me, renunciation, like practically, for me, pertaining to like states of being, like being a certain way, and it's to do with expectations, like, and if we expect things, like, it makes life less. Like it ruins the spontaneity of life. Like, and this is mm-hmm. what I think humans enjoy. Like, we there's more pleasure in this. Like, when we don't know what is coming next. So if we renounce expectations mm-hmm. of life, then it opens another door to just whatever happens and embrace it. Mm. You know? I don't know.
And we're much less likely to come into conflict with the present moment because we're open to the present moment as it is rather than expecting it to be a certain way.
Yeah.
In terms of internal conflict, it'll be there'll be greater freedom from that.
Mm.
Thank you.
I think we're quite blessed with a friend, and just he did a talk recently about learning to not become a victim in life, and I think that's been something that's really caused me a lot of pain in my life, because I think sometimes we feel awful is because we feel like always someone's hurting us or whatever relationships that you're talking about that cause us pain, but we don't see it from the lens that, oh, because I'm seeing it as a victim. So I would like to renounce being a victim in a sense that everything that has happened to me has happened for a reason to shape who I am, not the... Yeah, so it's my journey of learning to, I guess, be able to let go of certain things that happen in my life and say, hey, it's going to...
Yeah.
It's happening for me, not against me, in a way. So,
yeah, that's a lovely way of describing. We're all caught in old stories, and some of our old stories don't serve us well anymore.
Yeah.
And so, renouncing some of those, letting them go.
Mm.
Our attachment to those stories. Thank you.
Catherine, my answer to your question on renunciation, I'm trying to link it with the Buddhist renunciation. Yeah, you know, from my understanding, renunciation is a personal thing. Okay, yeah, you have to have you can influence people, but you can't force people what to renounce. You know. Your thing, like in the Buddhist one, okay, it's a personal inward thing, okay, yeah. And then, how they say, a lot of people, they have like dust in their eyes. You tell them things, they can't see it, you know. Mm. Though it's a good cause, it just goes through.
Mm.
You know, only those out in the Buddhist sense, okay, like the path, okay, only those few, you know, okay, who can see it, the thing, you know. It's an inward, you know, it's an inward thing, you know. And, how they say to expect a wider response, it's, I would say, hard. It might take time to do it, this thing, but you know, it's more like an inward thing.
Yeah.
That's my response.
Yeah, and at some point someone will have talked to you about it and it will have hit home to you and it will have made sense to you. So at different times, people talking about it is useful. So it's finding those times too. When it might be something that we're able to hear, because you know you're absolutely right about it not being something that can be imposed or that people will be interested in hearing.
Yeah. I'm trying to link this with the Buddhist teaching, you know. Yeah. Buddha was telling us, you know, it's most people, they have dust in their eyes, they can't see it, the thing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank and then you. It's only those, like his teaching, only a few people can grasp it. He was saying this thing. Mm-hmm. So I suppose like in renunciation too, because most people, they are, how they say, more towards like outward, you know. Their attitude to life is on the out pleasures, outside pleasures. You ask them to renounce, it's quite difficult, the thing.
Mm. Yeah, it is. It's difficult even when some of the dust has gone. Yeah. Thank you. Maybe one last person. Thank you.
For me, I think it was letting go of meat, which was quite difficult because I've lived with a family of meat eaters mm-hmm. predominantly, and I still have family that are meat eaters, and I think I've been vegetarian now for about a year.
Well done.
So it was a bit of a...
Terrific. And how's that going down in the rest of the family?
Oh, I get mocked.
Right. Yeah.
But that's okay. They just had their first vegetarian lasagna.
Hmm.
No one made any comment.
I loved it, yeah. It's very challenging for people when we make decisions that go against the business as usual. So it I think it is to be expected that people can, as a way of trying to deal with the discomfort that a different behaviour can cause, that mocking can be one way that they're trying to discharge that discomfort. Can happen. Yeah. Thank you all. Well, I'm happy to stay a couple of more minutes if there are people who want to have a bit more chat about this. And in the meantime, go well. And it might be a nice time if you're interested in dedicating the merit that we all have accumulated through the practice, through the meditation, through the reflection, maybe to the planet tonight. Go well.